Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the second morning session of our last day. The session will run until for an hour and 20 minutes and until another break. And then we'll continue on with more of the day. All right, our first speaker today is John Green. He's the CISSP. He is also the CTO for Aruba Government Solutions at HPE. And he's responsible for the security requirements of government customers worldwide. John's been with Aruba since 2003 and helped grow it from a small startup to today's position as a leading network provider. He holds a BS in information security from Western Governors University and an MS in computer science with a concentration in information security from James Madison University. And he's going to talk today about crypto. You're doing it wrong.
Thank you. I didn't know you were going to read that whole thing, or I wouldn't have sent that much stuff. Anyway, so they've given me 40 minutes today. I don't know that I'll take up a full 40 minutes, but maybe you can think of some of your own war stories and share them a little bit towards the end of this. So we'll see how it goes. But I needed to come up with a topic, and I thought, you know, the thing I'm best at doing is complaining about things that are broken. And so maybe that's what I'd get up and do here today, is talk about some of the mistakes we've seen related to crypto, just from a commercial product vendor standpoint. So, you know, what are we going to talk about today? Getting a FIP certificate, which, you know, people look at, and especially in this community, is kind of the mark of success in building a cryptographic product, is relatively easy. And I don't mean to make light of how long it takes to go through that or the amount of pain involved, but it can be done either as a FIPS module developer, someone that's building that software and certifying it as a complete module, or the approach of FIPS Inside, which we talk about, where you take somebody else's certified module and incorporate it into a commercial product, usually a level one certification at that point. So that part's relatively easy. Using it correctly, and in particular getting developers who build the product to use it correctly, is sometimes not so easy. And it depends a lot on how seriously they want to take it and how much effort they want to put in and how much knowledge those developers have. You find a very wide spectrum of knowledge from, I'm almost a cryptographer and I can speak the mathematical language, to, I don't know anything, I write Ruby on Rails and all that stuff is way down low and I don't care how it works, and everything in between. It's very possible and it's very common for a FIPS validated IT product to be out there not using FIPS validated cryptography. We find that again and again, so I'll give you some examples. So the first one is kind of DIY crypto. This product has a certified DRBG. It's got a FIPS certificate. It says I have a DRBG in the product. Can you guys read the code? Can you spot perhaps the issue with that? So this is Python, if you're not familiar with Python. And what they're doing is, it looks like, creating an AES key. And the way that they're doing that is calling into Python's random.seed routine and then reading random bits and writing it out to a key file. And they do it twice. They do one for an AES key and they do one for an initialization vector. So this could be good, or this could be bad, or this could be something in between. It's not FIPS validated. It's using a crypto routine from the Python programming language, which, fortunately for that, it at least tries to use an operating system source of entropy if one is available. So the Python routine that random.seed actually does a decent job at doing what it should do, unlike some other programming languages out there that I've seen, like Perl, for example, that just is quite ridiculous. So if you're generating random bits in a Perl program, for example, you're really not getting high entropy type output. The question, and we'll talk about this later on throughout the presentation, is this really a problem? Potentially, it could be a problem. Maybe not, depending on how we want to treat this notion of being FIPS validated. Here's another example. This comes from a Wi-Fi product. Won't mention the vendor. And I will say that this is a rather old problem, and so this is unlikely to be found in the world these days. In Wi-Fi, in WPA2, we have a concept of a pairwise master key, a pairwise transient key, a group master key, and a group transient key. Now, what's used over the air to encrypt data that's going from a wireless access point down to a client are the transient keys, not the master keys. But the master keys are used to derive the subsequent keys. If you have the master key, you can get the transient key. There's a group-wise master key that's used for broadcast multicast communication, and that key should be randomly generated. What's nice about the group key, at least, is there's not really key handshakes that have to go back and forth. It's really the access point tells the client over a already established encrypted tunnel, here's your group key, go use this. So the good news is we've got a product that has a certified DRBG in it, so we've got a good source of randomness. Can anyone spot the flaw in this piece of C code? This is the code that generates the new groupwise group master key. The hint would be the first word up there that says to do. So if you call this, you'll end up with a group master key that's filled with zeros. And that's not so good. Now, it's not so bad either because the group master key is not what's actually used over the air. You do have a transient key that actually gets employed later, and that does go through some key derivation. So you end up with a key that doesn't look like it's completely not random, but what you're getting out of this is basically 64 bits of entropy instead of 128 bits that you should have in this particular key. So they went and fixed it. Here's the new code. And I still ask the question, is that okay? Well, I didn't include the code that actually goes and gets the real randomness, but what it's doing is going to dev random on a Linux system and reading from that. So it's actually reading from effectively a raw noise source, but it's not using the certified DRBG. Why not? Don't know. This is not the final solution, by the way, but that was the first attempt that the developer to fix the problem. And that came up, you know, somebody thought to do, hey, maybe we should search the source code base and see if to do appears anywhere. Good idea. I probably would have done it before release, but I'm not a developer, so what can I say? So that's example two. We've got the crypto, it's certified, but we forgot to use it. Okay. Example three, if you've got a large sort of multi-module product here. So I'm not good with Java. I was for a little while, and I'm not. But this appears to me as though it's creating essentially a certificate store. I'm going to load X509 root CA certificates into the product. This thing's going to store them somewhere and presumably do some kind of processing. We are reading from Java libraries at this point, so we're importing all these java.security.stuff, and that's where presumably there's going to be cryptographic functions that are called in here at some point to read the certificate, to maybe do something with the private key, to maybe verify that a cert coming in is validated against that root CA. I'm presuming that. This code doesn't tell you that, but this code says basically, where am I getting my components for my crypto operations? Well, they're coming from Java. They're coming from the Java system libraries, not FIPS validated. Now, they could be. That's complicated because you can plug in other cryptographic libraries into Java with this JSSP, JSSE, I forgot. I'm not good with Java. So it could be, but it's not clear from just looking at the application code here that's actually happening. This particular product is sort of an appliance web application, and it contains compiled C code, it's got Java, it has Python, it has PHP, it has JavaScript, there's Go in it, there are Bash scripts in there, there's an entire Linux operating system that does stuff under the hood, and there's probably more. Maybe there's assembly in there too, who knows. This product includes a FIPS validated crypto library. It has a FIPS certificate identified with the product. It's OpenSSL. And as you might imagine, OpenSSL is a C library. Probably only the compiled C code that's linked against that is actually using the FIPS validated crypto in there. Now, again, it's possible there are connectors to other languages. We may be calling into that, but it gets complicated when we start looking at that. So from an obvious standpoint, only the C code is probably linked against that FIPS library. And again, I'll ask, is this really a problem? And we'll talk about that later. Depending on your interpretation of what's required here, that may or may not be okay. And it depends on what's actually happening. Now, maybe we're just using the Java routines because they're a convenient way to parse a certificate, to do ASN1 parsing. And we're just using that so we can read the certificate information. And the actual crypto operations are handled low-level in OpenSSL. That may be what's going on here. But it definitely requires some more investigation. So what's going on here? What's the deal? I think example two was just a plain old-fashioned bug. It was a developer who got in a hurry, who said, I'm going to come back and finish that later, and then didn't finish that later. And we've seen examples of that in real products all the time. I think it's not uncommon. Possibility two, developers don't really know where the crypto is being used. So sometimes they've forgotten, you know. Again, that bug with the group master key, I think that was a very old bug. That was in there from the very, very beginning of the product. People just forgot, and they, when you go back and say, okay, it's 8 years later, we're going to do FIPS. You know, most IT products don't start out with a goal of, I'm going to be FIPS validated. They say, you know, we start in the commercial market, we'll move into the government market later, and now we got to go back and retrofit all our stuff that's already there to add FIPS validation. People have forgotten over time, you know, what all is in there. A very common problem is you've got third-party or open-source code. Our products that we build are full of open source code that people link in because they don't want to rewrite, they don't want to reinvent the wheel. There's already something out there that does what I need it to do. And now the vast majority of those are not security related type packages. They're, you know, things that draw something on a web page, for example, or a graphing library, or, you know, you name it. But a lot of developers treat that open source code as essentially a black box. This stuff does what I need it to do. I give it this input, I get this type of output. I don't really care what happens under the hood. If it compiles, I'm happy. And a lot of times these days, they're not even compiling it. They're building a platform on CentOS or something, and they're just pulling down the RPM and loading the package. So they have no idea. They don't necessarily even know where the binaries live. So they can go and look at things like, what crypto library is this linked against? So we've seen cases where, based on open source code being included through RPMs, you end up with three different crypto libraries being installed on a platform, and you're not necessarily sure without doing a lot of investigation, well, which one is linked against what. The vast majority in the open source world does use OpenSSL, and so it's an easy job to go and say, I'm going to replace OpenSSL with something FIPS validated, and I can be in good shape. But that's not always the case. Some guy says, I'm going to use GNU TLS for what I want to do. It's installed now, not FIPS validated. Another big problem here is these multiple frameworks. I was never a very good programmer to begin with, and if I tried to get into software development today, it would be impossible because there's all these frameworks and packages out there with funny names given by the open source community, and you got to know what five layers of these things are before you can get anywhere. So I tried to write an iOS app once, gave up, couldn't figure out where do I even get started with a Hello World style iOS app because I had to know all these different frameworks. So you've got Ruby on Rails, and then you've got on top of that this other package, and then another package, and finally at the point where developers writing actual code, they're so far removed from what's happening at the hardware level or even at the operating system level, they just don't see it. So they may not even know that there's crypto out there being used because the applications that they built are so high up in the stack there. And that's becoming more and more common these days as there's more and more open source and there's more and more frameworks that are being reused for different things. On a slightly more negative note, developers know where the crypto is being used, but it's too much work to change and they don't want to do it. FIPS validation and compliance is not going to be the number one priority for a development team when you come to them and say, I need you to do this work. They've got a long list of things to get done, and so they're going to be looking for the shortest path to get something out there. And honestly, paying customers are going to come first before things like FIPS compliance and doing a really good job. So they may just lie to you and say, yeah, I did it. I don't want to say lie, that's a strong word, but it may just not get done because there's no time. You know, OpenSSL, the API, I think, is no secret. It's convoluted. It's a complicated API. It's not necessarily well documented, especially you've got products that were built on OpenSSL 0.98, and suddenly for FIPS validation, I need it to be 1.01. That's a lot of work. There was a lot of changes between those APIs that did not stay the same. So you're effectively rewriting applications at that point. That's a painful exercise to go through. We did it, I don't know, 6 years ago, and it was not easy and introduced a lot of bugs into the product. you do have cross-language APIs, so even if I have a FIPS-validated OpenSSL, it may be tough to link to it. So Python, for example, has bindings to OpenSSL. As far as I can tell, those bindings were written by one guy in his spare time. Don't know how well they are maintained, don't know if they have bugs in it. It's not necessarily straightforward when I've got stuff in one language and I need to go over to this other one, especially when I'm dealing with things like pointers that don't necessarily translate across different memory spaces. So it can be tough to try to use these cross-language APIs. They're helpful to have, but they can sometimes be tough. So how do you find these things? I've got some ideas for how we can do better as product vendors. The FIPS code review, shouldn't that find all these sorts of problems? A few people laughed. Valerie laughed. So all this code that we're looking at here is well outside the crypto boundary. A FIPS lab is never going to look at this stuff. And in a lot of cases, if you're using sort of the FIPS inside approach, where I'm taking an already validated crypto library and I'm dropping it into a product, the FIPS lab never looks at my application code. All they looked at was the crypto library to make sure it's correct. So FIPS code review is not going to catch this stuff. There's no path forward on that. Let's take the German approach. We'll bring back EAL4 because Common Criteria always did a code review, but when these Americans went to protection profiles, we got rid of all of that, and that's a big big vulnerability because we're not doing code reviews anymore. Well, guess what? The product in example number two that had the missing code that said to do, that went through EAL4. It actually went through EAL2 and then EAL4, and it did that twice for some bad reasons, with that flaw in it. Nobody caught that, and they should have, because that was definitely a security-relevant part of the code. It was directly related to the function that that product provided, and nobody saw it sitting there. What about product testing and doing things like automated testing? What about things like code reviews like tools like Coverity? Well, they're not gonna necessarily find this stuff. A lot of the product testing that's going to be done is going to be sort of black box testing, and so flaws that are internal, if they look correct on the outside, you won't necessarily catch them through that. Even that master key issue, I wouldn't have seen that even through doing some testing, unless I essentially wired up a Wi-Fi test suite to something like an entropy measurement tool and took a million samples through it and said, hey, your key doesn't look like it's high enough entropy. That might have caught it, but that's kind of very, very specialized, and I don't know anybody who would do that. Same kind of thing with the Python code there. If you see something that looks like a 128-bit AES key, probably it's good. We could take a million samples of that and run it through, you know, entropy analysis, and we might find something, or we might not. If our random number generator on the box is doing its job, maybe that's going to look perfectly good, but it's not FIPS validated. So are we meeting the letter of the law there? What really the only answer is I think a security focused code review that's trying to do an audit there. And in fact, that's where a lot of these things the examples I'm giving you, that's where those things came up, is somebody went through and said, I need to look for actual security impacting code in here. The issue is, you know, that's expensive. If you have an outside firm that comes in and does this sort of thing, that can be outrageously expensive. And it's a time-limited thing. They'll say, we'll give you 2 months of time, and it's going to be, you know, $250,000. It costs more than a CC evaluation to get some of that stuff done, and you may or may not get competent people on that. You just don't know the quality that you're going to get out of that. I found it's difficult to go to an engineering organization and say you need to dedicate a developer or developer time to doing code review on security stuff. They don't want to do it. That's maintenance to them, and it's not even just maintenance. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack. It's hard work to do that sort of thing, and it's hard to get a product development organization to take a step back from what they're trying to deliver to customers, and then go in and say we need to go back and look at this stuff. Something I've had some success with recently on product vulnerabilities is a bug bounty program. Now that's not opening up source code to people. That's saying from a black box standpoint, I will pay you per bug that you find in my product. And I've actually had a lot of success getting people to be properly motivated at that point to try to go after, you know, product issues. I'm looking at ways to do that from a source code review standpoint to say, I'll pay you per bug that you find. Now, the problem, of course, is you don't necessarily want to do that with your own engineers because they're going to insert bugs so that they can later fix them to claim the money. So I get it. That's a problem. But maybe you bring in outside firms and you say, I'm not going to pay you for a time-limited engagement. I'm going to pay you by the security-relevant bug. And based on the severity of that bug, I'll pay you more or less depending on what you find. There's issues with that, obviously, NDAs. People view their source code as being their core intellectual property, and they're loath to let somebody from the outside come and look at that, which I think is bogus, because I don't think, like, looking at Aruba Networks, our core IP is not the source code. It's the people that know what to do with the source code. So I think we could be a little more relaxed on that. So that, to me, is the only way forward, I think. And I don't have a perfect scheme for how to do that. We're kind of feeling our way through it to figure out how do we get more of this type of code audit taking place.
How is the bug found key different from backdoor testing? Isn't it the same?
They're recording, I guess, so.
How is the bug bounty different from black box testing? Are they the same?
It could be the same thing. In the way that I do bug bounty today, it's black box. I give somebody a product and I say, see if you can find vulnerabilities in this. And that gets you to a certain amount. So if you have, for example, cross-site scripting vulnerabilities in your web application, you can find that with that sort of black box testing. If you have, you know, SQL injection, this is the class of vulnerabilities you can normally find with that. The stuff I'm talking about here, I think, is very difficult to find from an outside black box perspective. I think you have to be looking at source code to be able to do that. And that most bug bounty programs that people have today are not focused on source code. They're focused on the other approach, which is the black box. I want somebody to sit there and stare at source code and go through it and find things like the missing key generation routine that was in there. But to properly motivate them, I think I need to pay them by the bug that they find as opposed to how much time they spend looking at the code. We're going to see. We'll see if that is different. So let me give you a few more examples. This is a FIPS validated product. This is going to, I forgot the name of the company now, SSL. It's an online, basically, SSL scanner that looks at your implementation of TLS from the outside and gives you a report back. Can anybody spot the problem here?
It's Qualys.
Yep, you're right. It's Qualys. Anybody see the problem here for a FIPS validated product? Sorry? Yep, cha-cha. What's that doing there? It's probably a perfectly good cipher. FIPS should probably pick that up and add it, but it ain't in FIPS today. So why is it in this product? What's going on here? So that was a real product. That was a real FIPS validated product with a FIPS certificate that was returning this. Interestingly, this was not coming up on the standard port 443, you know, HTTPS. That looked correct. This was a different port that was actually doing, still providing TLS for a different type of service, and the developer happened to overlook that. So what happened there? Developers installed a FIPS validated crypto library. Because they sponsored the conference, in part, I'll mention it was SafeLogic that got dropped on there to replace OpenSSL. So FIPS inside, we can legitimately claim to have a FIPS certificate number on this product. The developer never enabled FIPS mode. You have to enable FIPS mode, or else nothing else. All bets are off on that. So for OpenSSL, there's this FIPS mode set that you have to go through when you first invoke the crypto library on there. They didn't do that, and that's a choice you can make in a FIPS validated product. You know, we offer our Wi-Fi gear. You can load the FIPS image on that, and then you have a choice to make. Do you put the product in FIPS mode or not? Some customers don't, and they have good reasons for doing that. Now, not government customers, because they're required to, but there are other people that say, I don't want to run in FIPS mode, and that's a choice that you can make. They never edited the application config files to disable those non-FIPS ciphers. So in the case of it wasn't a web server, it might have been a database. I've forgotten what that was TLS protected. They just went with whatever the default config was. And what you saw on the previous screen was the default config. Now, fortunately, that default config actually looks pretty good. If you compare that to some of what's out there, some stuff is just crap. It's got export-grade ciphers enabled. It's got DES. It's got MD5. You get the whole gamut of, let's just include every TLS cipher that we possibly can. That's the default posture of a lot of open source components that you see out there. This one was actually pretty decent, but it did include that cha-cha and poly. Can never remember the number. If they had enabled FIPS mode and had that config, the application would have crashed, and it would have been an immediate signal to them that says you have to use this. So that was the issue there. Supplementary certification testing, like if you went through Common Criteria or if you went through the thing formerly known as UCAPL, it would have caught that. It would have, you know, they would have done scans on those ports and seen your TLS implementation is not compliant. What's going on here? And we would have been able to fix that. But FIPS just by itself doesn't necessarily catch that. Linux OS. A lot of products are built on top of Linux these days. A lot of products that used to be built on something else are moving to being based on Linux because it provides a very convenient sort of control plane for a network appliance. So we've got an appliance out there. It runs CentOS. CentOS happens to be a very common Linux distribution for use in embedded type network appliances or things that you would buy from a vendor and drop into a rack because it tends to be very stable. So we've replaced OpenSSL with a FIPS-validated crypto library. SafeLogic, again, is a good example of that, where it's binary compatible, drop it in, and you've got OpenSSL. So is everything cool now? We've replaced the system crypto library with something that's FIPS-validated. Are we cool? The answer is it's complicated. There are things that matter. There are things that probably don't matter, but it's a complicated example. The one that Steve likes to point out is this. Here's my shadow password file. I changed the hashes, so if you're taking a picture of that trying to break my password, you will fail. But we've got a shadow password file. Here is the hash of our password that's in that file. That is the thing that protects access to the entire system. If I can break this, I can break into the system, and all other security bets are off at that point. That hash was generated by the password program that's built into Linux. It went off and took my clear text password and went through some routines to basically turn it into that. Did it use FIPS validated crypto? There's a bunch of SHA that's used in this. There's 5,000 rounds of SHA-256 or 512. Was it FIPS validated crypto? I don't know. It's difficult to tell. Does it need to be? That's another good question. Does it need to be FIPS validated for the purpose that this box is providing here? Unclear. How about this? You also need to enable FIPS in the kernel. And this is particularly documentation from Red Hat, which applies to Fedora, applies to CentOS, applies to all the derivatives of Fedora, basically. There is a procedure for how to put the operating system itself into FIPS mode. So it involves basically setting this flag at boot time, FIPS equals 1, and then rebooting the system. That takes care of the majority of it. There are other packages in the system, and the one that I've become painfully aware of is OpenSSH. The Fedora project has extensively modified OpenSSH so that it reads that FIPS flag and does the right thing in terms of FIPS compliant behavior when that flag is set. And kernel crypto, if you're doing full disk encryption, that crypto lives inside the kernel. It reads that flag and it's going to basically refuse to offer you non-FIPS approved ciphers if the flag is turned on. So question, if we follow this procedure here, are we cool now? Are we operating with FIPS validated crypto? No, it's CentOS. Only Red Hat Enterprise Linux is FIPS validated. It's the exact same code, but it's not validated when you're using CentOS. It's only validated when you're using Red Hat. So again, we've got crypto in use in the product that, yeah, technically it's FIPS compliant. That's cool. And it's being compliant. You might fool everyone because nobody's going to ask questions if they don't see. The red flag is, do I see MD5? Do I see DES? Do I see export grade ciphers? If I don't see those things, I'm probably comfortable with what's going on here. So I'll give you my approach to this because I have to deal with this with developers all the time, especially developers of products that have had that product in the market for 8 to 10 years already. And we come back and say, we need to sell this product to the U.S. government. FIPS is like your number one priority to get us to that point. What should we do? It's really difficult to get this perfect, especially on a modern sort of Linux-based web application where you're doing all the things that I've talked about throughout this talk. I'm incorporating open source code. I've got a kernel that's in there that I didn't write. I've got lots of third-party code that's in there. I've got complicated frameworks to build my web-based application on top of. That's normal for today's applications that are out there. It's not really embedded devices so much. So yeah, smart cards are great, and even routers these days are probably more like this than they are like the old iOS of Cisco days, where it's kind of embedded systems. So this is really what we have to deal with. The approach that I've taken with these developers is, I'll summarize it by saying do the best you can, but the way that I kind of give it to them is, let's identify the services that actually need to be FIPS validated and make sure that they really are. I don't know, from a federal acquisition standpoint, if I'm in compliance with the rules here. I honestly don't know, because the rules sometimes basically say, you shall use FIPS validated cryptography for an information enabled product. What does that mean? Does that mean absolutely everything in the product has to be FIPS validated? The approach I've taken is, let's figure out what the services are that are really important for this product and make sure that those are. So if I have a network product, if I'm doing SSH, if I'm doing IPsec, if I'm doing Wi-Fi, let's make sure that those services, for sure, no doubts about it, are using FIPS-enabled cryptography. And that's what's going to show up in my FIPS security policy. If I have a file server and one of the features that I offer to customers is file encryption on that file server, I better make sure that that's using FIPS validated crypto. If I've got a database and it offers database encryption, that better be doing it. But think about the database issue. My network product has a database inside. It's used for storing certain configuration parameters. It's used for other stuff. It's not exposed to the outside. If I encrypt that database, does it need to be using FIPS validated crypto there? I think we can make a case either way on that. It's not an exposed service that somebody is using the product for. If I have a network appliance that's providing some web-based application, and that web appliance happens to use full disk encryption, does that full disk encryption need to be FIPS validated? I haven't claimed it in the security policy, so my position is no. Be clear in your marketing material what is and isn't covered by your FIPS certificate, and that to me is the best approach. Is to say, look, we're going to tell you what we did. We're going to tell you what we didn't do. It's up to you guys to figure out, is that a problem for you? Is it not a problem for you? Or don't take the other approach, which is, my FIPS security policy covers what's in the product. Anything that's not covered in that FIPS security policy, you can make no assumptions about it. Basically, buyer beware is kind of the approach on that. So I think vendors take both of these approaches on there, but I think it's really difficult to get it 100% right, despite what salespeople will come out and tell their customers. So that was it for me. I hope that was useful and maybe entertaining and maybe not too depressing. What do we have, 10 minutes? Anybody else want to share stories, ask questions, tell me I'm an idiot? Except you.
Take that away. Raise it up. So, I'm not 6 foot eight. So John, one question I had for you was, being at Aruba for the span of time that you have been and kind of all the different anecdotes you gave, do you feel like with the procedures and things you put in place that Aruba is kind of is catching more of these in advance of the testing? Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, that's a good point. This is sort of a progression for most commercial vendors, and we've learned a lot over time. We learned a lot when we went through the first protection profile evaluation for common criteria, and I got hauled into an office at NSA to talk about entropy sources and what we were doing and what we weren't doing. And it's funny because my FIPS lab told me, oh, you should seed your entropy source from DevURandom. And suddenly we went through this protection profile evaluation and that wasn't cool anymore. So we've learned a lot about that kind of stuff. But yeah, from a process standpoint, that's kind of the other angle here is, and it's both the maturity of a company, but it's also the marketplace these days. IT security 8 years ago was kind of like somebody else worries about that. There's so much stuff in the press now, ransomware attacks and people getting their video cameras hacked and that you don't get a lot of pushback anymore when you say, we got to do better on security, we got to do these sorts of things. So me instituting a bug bounty program 3 years ago, it was easy to get done. If I tried to do that 8 years ago, it would have been a totally different story. Ah, nobody cares about that stuff. So I think the federal certification stuff helps on that, because it gives me you know, we do decent business in the federal government. That's, I can't tell you what percentage of revenue it is for us, but it's a healthy line of business. I can go back in my engineering organization, and even if, and not that I've done this, but there's something stupid we're doing from a security standpoint, and I will say, that violates common criteria, and we will not be able to sell to the federal government if you don't fix this right now. I'm lying. It's not part of common criteria, but I use that as a hammer to get stuff done, and it actually works. So if you've got a significant amount of federal business, the certification stuff actually helps you both compliance, but also from the sort of a general security standpoint in improving improving products.
Could I ask?
Yeah. Yep.
Well, I'm tall enough. Okay. Could you shed some light more about the what could be common flaws pertaining defining the FIPS boundary, or at the time when you do adjustment to your product, and how that might be impacted?
Yeah, the FIPS boundary is an interesting one. So for contractual reasons on our Wi-Fi product line, those are all level 2 FIPS validations. So the sheet metal of the box defines the crypto boundary for that. And that seems to be just historical for what customers expect out of a Wi-Fi product. I don't know why that ended up that way, but they do mandate level 2. And so that's said, it's a pain for us because we changed one line of source code in the user interface that has nothing to do with security, and we got to revalidate FIPS, which is really stupid, but that's how it is with that kind of a product. So in theory, all of the source code on that level 2 product is inside the crypto boundary. In reality, am I going to ask my FIPS lab? You know, we do a change letter. We document every single source code change, but I can't expect them to look at every single one of those. It's up to us to identify which ones are security relevant for that, and I think we do a decent job on that. The other products where we've kind of drawn the boundary around the crypto library itself, that's where a lot of these types of things come in. Of yes, you have a crypto library that's a good boundary drawn around it, but how do the applications interact with that? Do they do it correctly? That tends to get overlooked, I think, and that's where we need to focus more effort.
John, I really like your practical approach to the security and going through the FIPS process. A kind of a light bulb went off in my head when you talked a bit about FIPS inside, throw it over the wall to your developers. Do you have, or does Aruba or HPE have, a document that says, if you're using the FIPS inside approach, here are the ways you should generate keys and do some of these things, that, like best practices? And if not, I'd like to help with something like that.
We have it to an extent. We could certainly use help from somebody who maybe produces a crypto library for a living.
Okay.
That would be helpful. I mostly have focused around things like ciphers and saying, here's your small group of ciphers that you can use. Don't pick this. Don't pick ChaCha. Don't pick anything that's MD5. That's about as far as I've gotten with the internal guidance so far. Other stuff. Put your library in FIPS mode. That's something else that I've said. But no, other than that, like an AES GCM initialization vector would be a really helpful thing to give some guidance on.
Morning. Kelvin Splunk from Cisco. You asked for stories from the field, and I can say one probably without getting lynched, because there are none of our hardware board designers here. A lot of our people working at the board level design will buy hardware-enabled crypto chips, accelerator chips from manufacturers, believing everything the salespeople tell them. Not a good thing, usually, because they don't always tell the truth. So I've discovered a technique to basically avoid that is find the names of all their contacts at the hardware manufacturers, speak to them directly, talk to their actually chip designers, and make sure that their chips are actually designed properly, that they work both with FIPS and CC. And then I don't get rude surprises about a day before the product gets released to sale that this was never done correctly. So it's been working for me. It's not always a practical thing for everyone to do, but yeah. Since we deal with about anywhere between 7 and 10 outside hardware manufacturers on the chip level, it's really been paying off because I can sleep at night.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and I've done the same thing. I've asked, copy me into an email thread with our hardware engineers with their suppliers. It's particularly come up on Entropy because we tend to be using those hardware sources for Entropy generation. And our hardware guys don't understand the questions to be asking. preferably, and this is the way it works most of the time with us, is we ask for FIPS algorithm certificates from our hardware vendors, and they're usually, if they know what they're doing, they can provide those things. And if they don't, we'd stop using them.
One thing now with the PAA and the PAI, now that there's this PAA, I got it right, the PAI list where it's implemented, I'm encouraging our manufacturers to talk directly to the people at NIST so that they make sure they get on this list so that, because there's always the diplomatic and bureaucratic problems of all these multiple NDAs going back and forth so that they can work with the lab, yeah. They can work with NIST, get on the list, and then I don't have to deal with all that unnecessary paperwork later on, and that I can be assured that these people actually have accelerated hardware that has met all the FIPS requirements well ahead of time.
Yep. All right, I'll leave you with the fact that every example I showed you is at least 4 years old, and so don't read anything into that. Thank you.
Okay, are you good? Are you wearing a fresh copy? Okay, so, but you're actually.
Oh, okay.
You're not the next.
I thought this was the E.
This is not. I do not believe this is Swapnila, and then these are the three speakers in this track. Where'd the cursor go? Hello, good morning, Swapnila. I'm just trying to get your. There it goes. I lost the cursor for a second there. Trying to find yours. There we go.
Not updated. I guess view.
Okay. I don't know why.
Why it's not showing.
You go ahead and introduce yourself.
No, why it's not showing my mother.
Okay.
Do you have to move it?
We probably have too many of these open. There we go.
I guess they have different modes and you move it.
Okay, let me just do it that way. Yeah, they, some of them they got set up in different ways, and it looks like this one, is this the right one? Oops. Updated, okay, they decided to do it their way. Some of them they did it this way, some of them they didn't.